but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
My good friend John Wilner is the co-host of the popular podcast, Canzano and Wilner, the podcast, appropriately named. John Wilner joining us now, Bay Area News Group, San Jose Mercury News. I got to know where your eyes are this weekend.
Big games on Saturday and starting early and going late. Absolutely. I'm curious about Oregon, you know, especially when you throw in the early kickoff factor. And I'm curious about USC, the Ducks and Trojans. I was thinking, you know, two easy home wins, and now they're going on the road to Big Ten country, conference openers against teams they should both handle. Or are they going to handle them to the degree everybody thinks, including the odds makers? I'm real curious about that. So those will be two, you know, the Pac-2 schools, quote unquote, both of them going on the road to Texas. Cougars at North Texas and Beavers at Texas Tech. Obviously, Beavers have a much tougher assignment there. But how are they going to hold their own? And the Washington State thing is kind of interesting because North Texas is kind of like a middle-level American program. And is Washington State able to keep pace with a mid-level American program? Mm-hmm. I think that will tell us a little bit about what to expect from the new Pac-12 next year.
I want to back up to Oregon and going a team from the Pacific time zone going east, playing an early kickoff game. I know that you've kind of geeked out on this over the years. Like what are your hunches and intuitions when you see teams making that trip eastward?
Well, I mean, the Ducks went east and played Purdue, and I believe that was a short week. I think it was a Friday night game
in
West Lafayette last year.
Yeah.
They blew Purdue's doors off, but Purdue was terrible. And the thing is, I don't know how much we're going to learn because Northwestern's not very good either. Northwestern lost to Tulane by 20. But generally speaking, you know, last year I tracked it. How did Big Ten teams do in conference games when traveling multiple time zones? And they didn't do well. They were 8-18 straight up, and against the point spread, they were 8-17-1, which I thought was very telling because the point spread, everything should be pretty close to 50-50 with the point spread. The fact that it was not anywhere near 50-50 kind of suggested that the teams didn't do nearly as well as you would have thought, even given, you know, disparity in talent.
Do you see the same type of thing when the teams on the east come west? Or is it a whole different calculus when you look at those games?
No, it was, I mean, the one everybody talks about, right, is the West Coast teams playing at 9 a.m. body time in the East.
Yeah.
But a lot of the traditional Big Ten teams coming west to California, Seattle, and Oregon, they did not do well either.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't know how much of it is the travel. They get some. The funky game times, you know, like, I mean, this you know, in 2 weeks, Michigan State's got to play an 8 p.m. Pacific game at USC. And I also think that coaches, both for the West Coast foursome and then the other 14, kind of had to figure out how to do it. How do you plan your practices during the week? When do you travel? What things do you do when you travel with hydration and nutrition and game planning to deal with not only the distance covered, but also, you know, the unusual game times? And I think that we'll see it. My guess is the teams will do better this year because the coaches will have adjusted a little bit with their preparation, but it's still hard. It's still real hard. And if Oregon were playing almost anybody else in the Big Ten, this, you know, anybody else in the eastern half of the conference, I think it could be tight. But, Northwestern is just not very good.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Dan Lanning complaining that, you know, in seven games this year in conference play, his opponent will have more preparation time. But I think their schedule, they're, you know, in the early part of the season just unfolds beautifully for them, trying to get Dante Moore ready, trying to, you know, hum on all cylinders heading to Penn State. But you're not sold yet.
Washington
on the
Ducks, has the same deal. You know, Washington's got the same deal. I think the Huskies are playing four teams that are coming off bye. So both Pacific Northwest teams did kind of get the short straw on the schedule. But the thing is, the Big Ten, and I've talked to them about this, they say, yes, there are certain years where you're going to get the short straw. But over the course of 3 or 5 years, it all balances out.
Do you think that balances out for Michigan and Ohio State or just everyone else?
Everyone else.
Yeah.
And
right?
The thing is, that if I were the Big Ten, I'd do the same thing.
Yeah.
Those are your big dogs, and you have to treat schools differently. And you know what? If the Pac-12 had treated USC a little bit differently, I think that maybe there would have been a different outcome.
Your AP top 25 ballot, you like Oregon, but you're not loving Oregon yet. What are you waiting to see?
I mean, I guess I should give them a little more credit for beating Oklahoma State like that, but I just don't think Oklahoma State's any good. And a lot of it isn't, and I have either Oregon – they're either sixth or seventh. I don't remember off the top of my head. But a lot of it is just that, you know, teams I have above them, except for Penn State, have played really good opponents. I mean, Miami beat Notre Dame, Florida State beat Alabama, Ohio State beat Texas, and LSU beat Clemson. And I just feel like you got to reward teams for playing high-level games early in the season. It's not really a knock on Oregon so much as it is saying, hey, nice work there. And then I've got Penn State and Oregon, kind of the two teams that I think are really good but haven't played anybody yet, are right in those 6-7 spots.
The top 25 ballot, I mentioned this on Wednesday's show. You know, I reached out to you. You don't get paid to do that balloting. How much time, effort, and energy goes into doing your ballot on a weekly basis?
Yeah, no, you don't get paid. The AP, they would never do that. I don't know how many of the voters, employers will allow them to take money for it. It's hard to say because some weeks it takes a lot longer than others. It all depends. I do it after all the games are over on Saturday night and I finish writing my column. So a lot of times I don't sit down to do it till 1 or 1:30. And it depends on the schedule, really, because there's some weeks where 20 out of the 25 teams beat cupcakes and there's not a whole lot of movement. Then there's some weeks where there's tons of relevant games and there's like, you know, standard deviation 5, you know, in terms of results affecting one team that affects another team that affects your number one team. And that can take an hour and a half or 2 hours. So I would say anywhere from 30 minutes to 2 hours, depending on the schedule of games and also the time of year.
You and I talked about this on the podcast this week, but we had Haley Sawyer, the USC beat reporter, who's just getting dragged on social media because of her ballot. And, you know, it's she probably just made a mistake. And she's mishandled maybe the fallout after, where she should have just come out and said, hey, I blew it. I'll do better next week. But you ever made a mistake on your ballot? Have you ever done something like that?
I have.
And you go,
Oh. Absolutely. I did. So I've been doing the football and basketball for, I don't know, 20 years now, 25 years. And I definitely have made some mistakes. To me, basketball is a little harder because there's so many more games you got to keep track of. But, you know, you can misread a result. You know, and I don't know if that's what happened with the Florida, South Florida thing or not. You can misread a result and put teams in different spots because of it. One time, I just forgot to include a team. I don't actually rank 25 on my ballot. I do 30. Hmm. And so I go down and I'm typing in 1 through 25, except I skipped, I think it was number 17. I just skipped over it. And so I ended up including the 26th team on my list as the number 25. So I had no idea that I had missed a team and I got hammered, and I should have gotten hammered, but that was the mistake. And the thing you've got to do if you make a mistake like that is just admit it and move on.
We addressed Oregon. You're also watching USC. I want to talk about USC and Lincoln Riley. They've played two games. not impressive opposition. They've run it up on them. Here they get a tougher test this week. What are you kind of expecting and looking for in this USC game?
Well, you know, the whole thing with USC is, are they tough? How tough are they? How well are they going to tackle? Are they going to line up with an empty backfield on fourth and one? You know, because that is one of Lincoln Riley's deals. And you know, you're USC. You should always be able to run the ball for short yardage. So I want to see just how they play. I think Purdue is actually certainly better than it was last year. Barry Odom is first-year coach. He's the guy who turned around UNLV. He's a really good coach, and he's going to be ready for the Trojans. I don't think he's got the personnel to hold up over four quarters, but I could see this game being, you know, a 10-point game late third quarter and things not going super smooth for USC because this is a step up in competition, even though it's Purdue. And the environment will be a little bit hostile, long trip. I'm curious to see how they do and just how committed is Lincoln Riley to run the ball.
And also the Boilers are honoring their 2001 Rose Bowl team. And our good friend Jerry Palm telling me that Rossade Stadium should be rocking for that one. he said it'll be rocking in there. But USC is a 21-point favorite in that game. I tend to agree with you. I don't think they're going to cover that number. And I think it'll be interesting to see. I like that, what you said, how tough are they? Speaking of tough, you've got Texas State playing Arizona State on the road. That was a really good game a year ago. I'm curious to see what ASU is going to look like bouncing back after a loss. How about you?
Absolutely. And the way they lost, right? You come all the way back from 17 down. You have this incredible 95-yard drive. You can't get in the end zone, but you go take the game-winning go-ahead field goal, and then you give up 58-yard touchdown because you're in zero coverage and you blitz and you get burned on the backside by the fastest guy in college football. Terrible, gut-wrenching way to lose, right? I mean, it's almost better if you don't come back, but you expend so much energy coming back and then you lose it. How are they going to do? They beat this team last year. So does that suggest a little bit of a letdown? Or was the fact that it was such a close game, it was a 3-point game in San Marcos last year.
Yep.
You know, is ASU going to really be on alert? It's a really, really interesting game. And it, like every other game this year with ASU, they don't have the horse to lean on. There's no scataboo to just overpower the opponent, get the big first downs, set the tone physically. They're a different team without him. We saw that in Starkville. They came out throwing. They had trouble throwing. They couldn't protect Levitt. He was discombobulated. It wasn't until they figured out the run game late that they kind of got control. They don't have scataboo, so that to me is a big story for them the whole season, not just this week.
You mentioned the Pac-2 schools. Washington State is at North Texas, 2-0 against 2-0. I love what Jimmy Rogers did in his second game. They found some identity, but this North Texas team is gritty. It's tough. It's undefeated, and it's playing at home. I think it's a really close game, but I think it's going to be a game in the 20s, and I think it'll be a very physical football game.
I do too. A lot of storylines here because, you know, with the new Pac-12 and the American and the rivalry that's going to happen there, North Texas's coach Eric Morris was the guy that recruited John Mateer and Cam Ward to Washington State in some ways, you know. So there's a lot going on, and also the heat, right? The heat is a big deal. And I've looked this week in Pullman, it's like 75 and sunny. Saturday in Denton, Texas, it's with the humidity, it's going to be over 90 in that stadium Saturday afternoon. So I think it is a 2:30 central kickoff.
Yeah, 12:30 our time.
To me, the Cougars can't be in position where North Texas says, you know what, in the second half, we're going to just preserve our lead and run the ball and just wear them down. Cougars need to start strong so that they're not vulnerable to North Texas just run the ball left and right in the second half.
Meanwhile, Oregon State, I had Trent Bray on the show on Wednesday. I know you listened to the podcast of that interview, and I left that interview a little frustrated because I thought he would come on. I thought he would try to do a better job connecting with his fans and maybe speaking to the fact that, you know, you can't drop an F-bomb. It makes you look undisciplined and disorganized as a coach. Or can't drop an F-bomb during your halftime interview. But what do you make of Bray and that whole scene and how Oregon State has looked?
I don't make a whole lot of it in terms of confidence that this is going to work out very well. His vibe has not been good. And I don't think it was not to me just that one interview with the expletive. His halftime interview at the Cal game, the opener wasn't great. I didn't think he doesn't to me give off the even keel, you know, mature head coach vibe. And I think that that's something they got to work on. Certainly, I'm not convinced that they have got the schemes and the people in place for those schemes. Special teams was a mess, but it's more than that. They weren't ready to play in the Cal game. Season opener at home, you're not ready to play. And last year, the second half of last year was bad, and I didn't think that they managed the quarterback situation great last year in October, November. So I still got a lot of questions, to be honest with you, about this. And there's not a lot of time. They can't be in position where they're falling. They're behind when the new Pac-12 comes online next summer, right? They got to be ready to compete for a title, or else there's a lot of repercussions to that. So we'll see.
Wasn't his move, because he comes into the post-game news conference, he tells me on Wednesday that his AD talked to him and reminded him that he needed to apologize, and so he does. Then he comes on my show. I mean, there's a lot of people who never heard the apology. Wasn't the right move for him there to be like, hey, I've got to do better, and, you know, I'm sorry if kids heard that, and man, it, you know, it's not my best. I need to be poised in that moment and in control. And instead, he almost kind of was like, I'm not very good at this. It's an area I'm trying to improve in. And then he distanced himself. He said, you know, my players and coaches were really frustrated and disappointed. And then I asked him about the fans. And I said, well, what about fans? Don't you think they're frustrated? And he said, yeah, fans buy a ticket. They expect to see you win. I find head coaches, good head coaches, will be like, we're all in it together. Fans, because he needs those fans to give money. He needs them to support the, you know, Damnation Collective. He needs them to buy tickets. And I don't think he's doing a good job of that right now.
No, and again, all points to a guy where you can wonder, is he ready for this, right? And it's hard for first-time head coaches in that regard. The media piece, the public-facing piece, it's tough, but it's also important. And if you're not comfortable, it shows, it gets exposed easily. And there are next level repercussions for sure with your constituents. So, yeah, I mean, that would have been the right move for him. But, you know, does he know that was the right move? Is he confident enough in his own skin to be able to admit something like that? Or is it just still a little bit defensive because he's not completely comfortable?
Finally, 2:30 games late. It'll be Minnesota at Cal. There's a team coming west. It'll be Boston College at Stanford. There's a team coming west. Can you break those down just a little bit, what you're looking for from Cal? Because I think that Cal game's really interesting and maybe a big one for Justin Wilcox. And then Stanford's just trying to hang on.
Duh, boy, they're terrible. Terrible. They are in the running for the worst power conference team in the country. I think Oklahoma State's probably in that running. We'll see. Northwestern might be, but Stanford is really bad, and they got an interim coach. You know, the quarterback, the transfer from Oregon State, Ben Gulbranson, has not played well. They are just in disarray. Boston College lost in overtime at Michigan State last weekend, goes home, got to turn around and fly across the country, and I still think they're going to win handily. Cal game's real interesting. You got a middle-tier Big Ten team in Minnesota that's well-coached, and you got what's probably a middle-tier team in the ACC in Cal. Now, maybe the Bears are better than that. We'll see. This is a big step. Their quarterback, Jaron Kiavae Sangapolutelli, I get caught on that sometimes, JKS, he's really good. You know, we saw at Oregon State, he's really good, but this is a next level defense for him. It's a well-coached Big Ten defense. How's he going to do? Are his receivers going to make plays? Very telling. I think if Cal wins, then they got San Diego State next week. And they could be 4-0 non-conference, and that puts them in line for like an 8 or 9 win season.
Yeah, and you also look at that Cal coaching staff. You got Brian Harsin, you got Nick Rolovich. Do you think Rolo parlays this into a head job? Harsin parlays this season into a head job? I mean, are those guys going to get that sort of that reclamation and restoration that Steve Sarkisian and some others, Lane Kiffin, got at other places?
I don't know about Harsin because of the way things went at Auburn when he was the head coach. I think Rolo, and I've heard from people up there that he's doing a great job. Kids really like him. And Rolo is a really good offensive coach. Technically, he is a senior offensive analyst, I think is his official title. I think Rolo could catapult into offensive coordinator position at a Power 4 school off of this, and then potentially to a head coach a few years down the road. You know, he didn't fail as a head coach like Harsin did at Auburn. Rolo failed because of the vaccine situation. I think that'll be easier for program schools to overlook if he proves himself for a few years as a coordinator. And he's very sharp.
Would he be right for UCLA or Oregon State if they make a change in a year or so?
I don't know about UCLA because I just don't know about the politics down there with his stance, right?
Would Oregon State would they dare take the guy that sued the other school, the other Pac-2 school?
Yeah, I don't know. They might be worried about that. But he certainly, from a coaching standpoint, that's what they would need, I would think. UCLA, interesting. Deshaun Foster, similar situation to Trent Bray, right? Alum in his second year, a lot to prove. I don't know. Would Oregon State hire Nick Rolovich? Boy.
I don't think
so. That's a fascinating question. You don't think so?
I don't think so. Politics? I just think that room is too small with, you know, they were in it with Washington State, and could they really take that guy that, I mean, it would be a big, hey, we're all in it for ourselves move, which everybody else does, but we shall see there. And then Foster,
he could get a job with one of the other new Pac-12 schools, though. No doubt about that.
San Diego State, somebody like that. But hey, let me ask you this too before you go. The idea that Deshaun Foster is wobbling, he's not letting his assistants or not letting anybody talk to the media this week. He's looking paranoid, not focused. His team's not playing well. I kind of think Oregon State will stick with Trent Bray and be patient because they don't want to pay him. But what will UCLA do if Foster continues to lose games? Do they become a buyer for Jonathan Smith or somebody like that?
I think so. I don't know what Foster's buyout is off the top of my head, but I can't be very much because he had no leverage to negotiate that contract when Chip Kelly left. So I think if UCLA ends up 3-9, 4-8, they're going to have to seriously think about making a change because they cannot continue to lose ground. The more ground you lose, the harder it's going to be to make it up in the Big Ten. They're already in trouble financially, so you'd say, well, if they're in trouble financially, then they can't buy them out. But you could also argue if they're in trouble financially, they have to do everything they can to get it turned around because they got to put people in that stadium and they got to get relevant and they got to get to the postseason. I think he's in over his head. And in a lot of the same ways, I think Trent Bray might be in over his head. We'll see.
Yeah, Foster's
the next 2 months, but we'll see.
Foster's buyout. Foster's getting $3.1 million a year on average in that contract. So he'd have 3 years remaining, $10 or $11 million remaining after this season. So if they fire him on or before December 1, they'd owe him 70% of the remaining salary. So it would be $7 to $8 million that they'd be paying to buy him out.
Given the alternative and the potential to lose another season of football next year, they're going to have to think hard about it if this thing doesn't get turned around.
John Wilner, you're the best. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks for having me.
And there he goes, John Wilner, my co-host on Canzano and Wilner, the podcast. He does good work on college football. Coming up, what's on tap this weekend? I'm going to tell you next. Leave it here. You got the bald-faced truth statewide.